Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We've got a busy show as we kick things off with psychologist Dr. Frank Farley talking about PTSD for World Mental Health Day. What really is PTSD, and can anyone suffer from it, or is it just military personnel? Social media expert Patrick Charles talks about sound exchange and what it means for streaming music. ER physician Dr. Zach Levine joins us to talk about chest pain and the reasons behind it. Then we wrap things up with the talented Canadian band Hey Ocean and their catchy new song, Make a New Dance Up.
Capture your need for sound.
In October, not only do we mark Breast Cancer Awareness Month, but we also acknowledge World Mental Health Day. Mental health is so important, but often gets stigmatized because for the most part, we cannot physically see the problem like we could if someone had a broken arm or leg. To pay homage to good mental health, today on the show, we will talk about a mental health issue that has been in the news quite frequently in the last several years, but is often misunderstood. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Joining us to talk about PTSD is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Dr. Farley, thank you for joining us again on the Kelly Alexander Show.
You're welcome, Kelly.
So, Dr. Farley, can you please explain what PTSD really is? Because I think often this term gets thrown about as if it were nothing.
Yes. The term refers to post-traumatic stress disorder. So, a traumatic event has to occur. So you are involved in a terrible accident, let's say, or you're a rape victim, or you're a combatant in a war in Afghanistan, perhaps, or Iraq, or wherever, and something terrible happens. There's three ways to respond. One is if you are directly involved. So let's say that you are the rape victim. A second possibility is where you witness the event. So you witness some traumatic event. And the third one is where you learn of it. You hear about it. Somebody describes it to you. So clearly the most traumatic is to be directly involved, be a part of it. And it shows itself in various ways. The core symptom is what we call intrusive memories. That is, over time, you keep re-experiencing the event. It's like you can't get it out of your head. And so there's these intrusive memories about the events. You may have flashbacks all of a sudden to the very event. You may have dreams where it occurs in dreams or daydreams or even consciously during the day. And so you re-experience the event, and it's hard to get rid of it. Another quality that often occurs is avoidance. That is, you avoid settings that might remind you of that traumatic event. A third category is persistent negative changes in your mood. So, for example, you may feel detached from people around you. You may feel numb, sort of just no emotion at all. And then finally, another thing that can happen is arousal and reactivity. Angry outbursts. You suddenly feel angry. You may feel irritable. You may take self-destructive or reckless behavior. So those are really the four ingredients, the intrusive memory, that is re-experiencing, avoiding things associated with the event, negative changes in your mood, such as feeling very numb or detached, and then finally, sometimes very reactive or aroused, like irritable. So those are the main ones. And again, the key ingredient that occurs in nearly all of these cases is this flashback, re-experiencing the event.
I think a lot of people believe that it's mainly soldiers that go through this PTSD. So I wanted your thoughts on that. And also, just by some of the descriptions that you've put out, I'm assuming that let's just say for September 11th, like 9/11, back when it happened in 2001, there's the first responders who I'm sure would have PTSD. But what would you say about people who were in nearby buildings or something? Like, could they have walked away with that too?
Yes, they could. As I mentioned, there are sort of three levels. One is you're directly involved. So the first responders who went into the building as it was, you know, almost collapsing, versus those who were observing it from maybe down the street and the dust and everything was beginning to engulf them. But they weren't right at ground zero. Or maybe they're even further away. They're in a building looking at it. And then the final ones would be the people who maybe saw it on television.
Okay.
So those are the three. And the ones most susceptible, of course, are the ones who are on site in real time where the action was. But combat experience, things like 9/11, rape, I mentioned rape, childhood physical abuse, sexual molestation, a physical attack. You know, you get attacked walking down the street, for example, or you're threatened with a weapon. Someone pulls a gun on you, and you're all alone, let's say, on a dark street. You know, that's pretty traumatic. So it can come at you in many different ways. I'll give you a concrete example in Ottawa about 3 weeks ago when that bus, the front end of the bus was severed by a train.
Mm-hmm.
And what? I think maybe six people died. The driver was decapitated. Those people who were on that bus might well suffer PTSD. They were there. They were part of it. And then there were people who saw it happening. In fact, some people apparently took cell phone photos of it. And then there are other people who would read about it.
I wanted to ask you as well, you did describe, I would say, the main symptoms of PTSD. Are they always present? Like, is it like almost like a checklist, like bang, bang, bang is going to happen? Do they vary? Like, is it usually textbook, I guess, is my question, when someone is going to experience this or is experiencing this?
It's not exactly textbook. The key ingredient, as I mentioned, is this intrusive memory thing, sort of re-experiencing the event, flashbacks. You can't seem to, you're having these flashbacks all the time to the event as if it was happening all over again.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key diagnostic criterion. And the others can vary a little bit from person to person. It may depend on the severity of the event itself. It may depend to some extent on whether you've gone through anything like it before. That is, do you have some prior experience with this kind of an event? You know, for example, if you're a combatant in war, you're a soldier, you may have already experienced things somewhat similar. But some soldiers, it might be totally new. And so the symptoms may vary a little bit depending on the conditions.
Do children act differently than adults do to PTSD? Like, is it, like, again, I guess it's just simply that question. And then can they get through it easier or is it worse for them?
I wish we had definitive answers to that, honestly. And I'm no expert on children and PTSD. There's a lot less research on children and PTSD than there is on adults. But the most recent version of what's called the DSM-5, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, what that is the sort of psychiatric Bible that lists all the different diagnoses. In the most recent version of that diagnostic volume, children's PTSD has been changed somewhat, some of the criteria, and they've sort of lowered the threshold for diagnosing PTSD in children. And they sort of set up a few additional characteristics for children younger than 6 years of age. But in a nutshell, children can get PTSD, yes, and they will show some of the same symptoms that you would get in older persons, and you can use some of the same strategies for treating children that you can use with adults as well. So there are some similarities and some differences, let me put it that way.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show, Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Is this true, this statement, Dr. Farley, that some people get PTSD and others do not? Like, let's say you're exposed to the same situation. Will some get it and some won't? Or will some get it to varying degrees? Like, how does that work?
The best research at this point says the following, that PTSD in response to extremely high stress or trauma, what we call high traumatic load or stress, most people will get it, will get PTSD at really extreme levels of stress. At lower levels, it varies. Some people get it, some people don't. And the best current evidence suggests that there's some degree of genetics involved, some heritability. The studies range across the board, but the current studies suggest anywhere from 30% to 70% of PTSD may be genetic at these lower levels of stress, lower levels of trauma. But at the highest levels of trauma, it seems that just about everybody gets the symptoms.
If we go back to 9/11 for just a second, obviously, because that was just such a huge, huge thing for so many people. And, you know, it upset me and I wasn't even in the country or near it at the time. I remember actually watching, reading an article the following day. I was working in Toronto at the time and the Toronto Star actually put out, I think, the first afternoon version that they had done in God knows how many years. And I remember seeing a picture of the falling man, I guess. And my knees actually buckled just watching that. And so I knew, like, it bothered me, you know. But if people were actually in the area of New York, let's say people went to go, I'm sure there was a lot of people that drove down just to see it. Like, are these people still suffering from it? Or because it has been 12 years now, like, are first responders potentially still dealing with it? Like, is it treatable?
It is treatable. We don't have a magical treatment, you know, a magic bullet or anything to treat it. But by and large, it seems to be treatable through medication and in concert with psychotherapy as well. One approach is called cognitive therapy. Another is called exposure therapy. They both seem to be fairly effective. But the evidence isn't in yet. Some people, it will just stay with them, you know, and particularly if they experience a similar event later on down the road. Anything kind of similar to the original event may sort of reignite the problem for them. But by and large, PTSD is to some extent treatable. It's not perfect. But we do have therapies that seem to be very helpful. I mentioned cognitive therapy. I mentioned exposure therapy. There are some drugs that seem to be helpful. But, you know, when we're talking mental health, it's a complex topic. And there's a lot of uncertainty in just about all of our treatments. And the interesting thing about mental health is, you know, no one treatment works for everybody. And some people, you know, you can treat very effectively and others less well.
Again, if we go back to 9/11 for just a second, because I just want to know if this is, if it correlates. For example, I know that a lot of first responders ended up committing suicide in the years following. Would that be associated to PTSD, or is that like depression or something completely different? Like,
It could be associated with PTSD. Severe anxiety and depression can go along with PTSD with some people and be a sort of comorbid condition. And so depression may go along with it for some folk, and severe anxiety, that may be a factor that predisposes to suicide, yes. So, you know, in my view, it's probably associated with the original, event, which was 9/11 for those who committed suicide. But again, you know, sometimes it gets complex. It may be that a person gets changed after such a traumatic event, and that that then changes their relationship with other people, with their job, etc. And, you know, their life begins to sort of cave in on them, you know, and they things start to pile on and they have trouble dealing with it all. So it may be that the 9/11 event was the predisposing or the original stimulus, but other factors may then come into play later on.
What do you say to family and friends of a potential, you know, a person who is going through PTSD? What do you want them to understand? What do you want them to know?
Well, I think it's, you know, enormously important that they take care of themselves, that they don't self-medicate. You know, some people start drinking alcohol or taking, you know, drugs, non-prescription drugs, to self-medicate. Those are not good ideas. And of course, if this is interfering with your life and your social life and your mental life, you need to see a professional. And we have lots of trained psychologists and psychiatrists in Canada and the United States who can deal with this problem. So my gosh, if it's interfering with your life, don't hesitate for a minute. Go and see a professional about it. I guess other things would be that, you know, share your concerns with loved ones, talk things over, realize that other people have experienced this thing. It's not just totally novel with you, and that there are means of treating it and dealing with it.
And I wanted to ask you this as well as the final question. If someone does go through a, you know, a traumatic event, and because PTSD has been bandied about, like I think a lot of people are aware of it, even if they don't quite understand it, do you think a person who, again, might be experiencing PTSD, can they be self-aware that this might be going on? Or is it really up to someone else to spot the symptoms? Because I'm just wondering, can you sort of, not self-diagnose, but be aware like, oh, maybe this is a problem. Like, maybe I do need help.
Well, it's hard to say. You know, it's a case by case. People differ one to the next. But, you know, if they're beginning to have flashbacks to that traumatic event that they experienced, they just sort of can't keep it out of their mind, that may be one thing. If they just feel numb and kind of detached from people, that may be another thing. If they avoid situations, that when they think about why they're staying away from that situation or avoiding it, and they suddenly realize, oh, that's where that terrible thing happened to me, and so they realize that. Or if they're highly irritable, you know, any of those things, which, you know, many people will discern and see in themselves. Some people will be less self-aware, but maybe other loved ones will comment to them. Then they should see a professional. And by the way, you can also go online and look up things like PTSD, and there's a wealth of useful information online. So there's so many websites. There's, you know, WebMD, the Mayo, M-A-Y-O, the Mayo Brothers Clinic has a wonderful website. The Canadian Psychological Association has a website where one can go and learn a lot from that. I would assume that would be cpa.org, but I would have to check on that. But the Canadian Psychological Association, headquartered in Ottawa, is a terrific organization, and they have all sorts of information online. If you're not discerning it yourself, but other people are telling you things, then you need to initiate some action. Let's put it that way.
Perfect. Dr. Farley, thank you so much for your time today. As always, we appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
We always associate digital technology with the young, and for good reason. It seems to be their domain. New research from a company called Sound Exchange, however, points out that when it comes to streaming music, some older acts are still really all the rage. Joining us to talk about all of this, our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Patrick, hello.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, good. So I'm very excited because I have never even heard of Sound Exchange in my life ever.
Oh, okay. Well, they've actually been around for some time, and they were founded in 2003. So what they do basically is they collect royalty payments, meaning every time something gets played, they collect that money for the artists and the rights holders, meaning, you know, because sometimes the record labels actually own your sound recordings and not you, the artist. So they collect money for everybody involved.
Oh, okay. Is it kind of like a SoCan, like something like that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a collection house.
Okay.
You know, like it's a collection house for all of the stuff that gets played, and they keep track of who should be getting what.
Gotcha. Okay. So, when it comes to this, does this actually go against the idea that the older generation hasn't embraced technology? Because I know there are some people that are very savvy and then my parents
right.
who are not.
Well, here's the thing. This is the interesting part because they did a survey of all of the music services that they collect royalties for, and that's over 2,000 services, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Right? So the most frequently streamed artist of the past decade,
mm-hmm.
drum roll please.
Can I guess?
Elvis Presley.
Oh, Elvis Presley. Actually, yeah. I was going to say Beatles, so that makes
yeah
Elvis Presley. My dad.
Well, you're on the right track because after that you've got Springsteen.
Yep.
And then Pearl Jam.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
I've never
crazy.
Even thought about that.
But after that, it gets a lot more sort of modern because number four is Rihanna.
Okay.
Number five is Drake.
Yep.
Number six is Usher, which I thought was interesting.
That is interesting.
Right? Yeah. Lil Wayne is number seven. And the Beatles are at number eight.
Wow. So they're sort of... Wow. Okay. But I guess, again, it comes into play with the age range, potentially.
Yeah. Well, it's a couple of things. First of all, because the Beatles, there are pretty strict rules for the way the Beatles stuff is handled.
And is that because, first of all, maybe you have the answer to this, because I've heard before that it's difficult to deal with their stuff. Who owns their stuff? Is it Paul McCartney? Is it a bunch of them? How does this work?
Yeah, it's a bunch of people that have to do with it. I believe it's Paul McCartney, it's Yoko Ono, and also Sony.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, because remember, Michael Jackson bought a whole bunch
yep.
of the Beatles stuff. And then when Michael Jackson got into really heavy debt with Sony, who were his record label, he gave them a good chunk of the Beatles catalog.
Does he own anything anymore, or is it all gone?
No, I think it's all gone, actually. I don't think okay. Michael Jackson's estate owns any Beatles music anymore. I could be wrong,
okay.
but I'm pretty sure he gave up, or actually, no, you know what? I am wrong. I think they gave up half of what he had, so they probably own about a quarter of it.
Okay. And this, I know this is off topic for just a sec, but didn't this situation sort of wreck his relationship with Paul McCartney?
Absolutely, but who cares?
Yeah, exactly. Who cares?
He made so much money off of that.
And he needed it, because as we could see, he spent there was the no tomorrow, so.
At the time, yeah, he was so deep in debt, Michael Jackson, but that Beatles catalog helped him quite a bit.
Wow. So bringing it back around then, does this, what does this teach the industry as far as marketing? Do they need to reevaluate and go, hey, maybe our older generation still knows what's going on?
Yeah, I think they do, because it's all over the map. I mean, we always talk about, you know, people buying vinyl again and the fact that, yeah, you know, older people have a lot of interest in music and stuff that they used to listen to and stuff that they will listen to in the future. And so, yeah, I think that they do have to use these artists to market these services. For instance, satellite radio
mm-hmm.
is one of the things where that plays, you know, the Beatles and Elvis the most, because they have dedicated channels on satellite. And it's pretty interesting because, I mean, that still counts as digital streaming, right? I mean, if you have a satellite subscription and you happen to listen to the Beatles channel all day,
mm-hmm.
well, you're streaming the Beatles.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So I actually have to say, though, as I think back to the list, I'm sort of surprised that Elvis is number one, and then it's back to modern kind of thing, apart from Bruce Springsteen. And then
yeah, right.
The
it is kind of funny. I think the reason why the Beatles are that low, though, is because with the other streaming services, it is very difficult, as you asked me before, to deal with the Beatles. They don't allow – there are a lot of complicated rules. It's like if you have a Beatles station on a streaming service, normally you can only play one song per hour, and then it has to be song sort of related to – it's a whole – complicated thing because Paul McCartney's still around making problems for everybody.
Right.
So yeah, I think they would have turned up a lot higher if you could freely stream the Beatles on RDO and Spotify and those kind of things without any problems.
Are you surprised that if we look at social media for a second, Bieber, Rihanna, Rihanna's in there too, but like Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, and if I can, you know, specifically point out Bieber and Gaga, I think they still have the most, you know, Twitter and Facebook followers. Are you surprised that they're not up there?
Well, you know what? No, and I'll tell you why. Because what's interesting about this is that SoundExchange doesn't monitor YouTube because they're not, you know, collecting money for them.
Oh, okay.
So I think a lot of people that listen to some of those acts that you mentioned are just streaming stuff on YouTube.
Right.
They're not even going as far as like an actual streaming service or anything. So YouTube views are, I mean, it's ridiculous. That's probably the thing that makes you at this point.
Okay. Now, is anything affecting this trend?
Here's the thing. I mean, first of all, yeah, because, you know, satellite radio was one really big thing. And again, like YouTube not being part of the equation in a sense, because nobody's really counting YouTube views as far as artist popularity, although I think they should.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, there are Beatles albums that get posted on YouTube and they get immediately ripped down, but a lot of people view them. I mean, if you put up a Beatles album in full on YouTube, it'll get hundreds of thousands of views. Okay. Because people want to listen to this stuff. So, yeah, that's definitely affecting it.
So do you think all of this is going to continue? Is it going to be more prolific? Will it take a dip? Like, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's going to keep going this way. And I think that as time goes on, I mean, you won't have much of a choice but to stream stuff. So I think this trend is going to stay almost exactly where it is, in a sense, because when these acts are really old, I think people will still be streaming them because they won't want to go out and buy CDs or pay for downloads or whatever. So it's going to maintain this same sort of a gap between new acts and older acts.
Now, here's something that's going to make me look like a moron, but I'm going to say it anyways, because I don't stream. Like, I either, you know, go get it, go buy the CD, whatever it is, I sort of do it that way. Or right. I just download the song. So when it comes to streaming, can you pick the album to stream? Can you pick a track to stream? Like, is it all?
Oh, yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
So you totally have the choice.
You have all the control, really.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. Okay, because I figured as much, but I really just don't ever stream.
No, that's cool. I mean, somebody's got to be buying those downloads.
Yeah, someone needs Someone needs me.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, you can stream a full album. Absolutely.
Okay. And as the current youngsters, if you will, sort of graduate into young adulthood or whatever, do you think that list is going to change, or do you think that Elvis is still around for a bit?
Well, I think it'll change and it won't change. I think there'll be, you know, a new Elvis,
right?
A new old Elvis, if you know what I'm saying. I think somebody else will sort of take that crown, and it'll be someone who's been around for a while, and you'll say, oh, this guy, you know, maybe it'll be, I don't know, Michael Bublé or something. You know what I mean? But I think it'll be the same kind of thing. I think you'll always have the acts who sort of really resonated with our generation. I think you'll always have them being, you know, continually listened to.
I wonder where my Janet is. I wonder where she is in this list. She's probably
It's weird.
50.
I mean, she's had a really funny career over
the last decade. Did not work out ever since the Super Bowl fiasco.
No.
She has like kind of quasi tanked, like not entirely, but like it's there. And it's sad because, for example, her 2008 album. Well, first of all, Demita Jo, which is the album that came out during the Super Bowl fiasco, that was actually a strong album. But because of everything, she just didn't get the support from her label and all that kind of stuff. And it just tanked. And then the 2008 album was really good as well, Discipline. And then that just didn't go anywhere either for her. Like her record company basically dropped her and didn't support her. So, and that's her tour went then crapped out. Like it hasn't been a good, that the 2000s were not a good decade for the Janet. So hopefully it'll, but it's weird how certain artists can pull it around again. Like I feel like if she, because I know she's working on new music as we speak, and if she actually can pull it around, she can sort of pull it around like Jennifer Lopez did.
I'm going to tell you what it is, though, with her. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same thing that would have been affecting Michael Jackson had he still been around right now.
Okay.
And it is the fact that they are very much the old model of showbiz. I know this is a whole different topic altogether,
but
I find that the Jacksons are a very old model of showbiz, meaning that Janet is still very closed. You know, you don't see a lot of, like, social media activity. You still don't see any big revelatory interviews.
Yeah, no.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, as long as you're going to be like that, you're going to remain that way, I think you're going to have a hard time getting the word out for a new record. And I mean, 2008 was the last one, and that was before the whole sort of social media explosion. But I think right now, if she's going to drop an album, she's going to have to do some YouTube videos in the studio. She's going to have to do a lot of, you know, sort of appearances on Jimmy Fallon. And do you know what I mean? Like, she needs to do, like, basically she needs to do what Justin Timberlake does before his record comes out.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know what, you're right. I would agree with you. And the funny thing is her ex-husband was really great at that. Like, he, I don't know if you remember that, but like in the early 90s, like, he was one of the first ones to sort of jump on the internet bandwagon and sort of get her going. Like, she would do these fan forum chats, and they would surprise their fans and sort of come on and not announce that they were coming on, and then all of a sudden we'd go like, oh my god, Janet's in the forum, you know? And that was all because of him. And then when that fell apart, the relationship, she really never turned around, because you're right, she barely tweets. Like, she will tweet like once a month, and that's not going to cut it. So you're right about that, Patrick. Thank you, as always.
Thank you, and I'll see you next time.
Excellent. That is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Make sure to follow him on our website, kellyalexandershow.com, as well as on Twitter, @getpatrick.
Capture your need for sound.
One thing we all have seen on television are those aspirin commercials that showcase people who have gone through chest pains and heart attack symptoms. It's unsettling to watch these testimonials, but even worse if you've gone through them in real life. Joining us on the show to give us some advice about how to handle a situation like this is Dr. Zachary Levine, an ER physician at the Montreal General Hospital. Dr. Zach, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So first of all, can you clarify that chest pain doesn't just happen to middle-aged, overweight guys who eat too much and don't exercise?
Well, certainly chest pain happens to anyone, any age, any gender, any race, any religion. It can happen to anyone, and there's many different causes for it, too, you know, that's from which we'll talk about, but, you know, anything from a heart attack to anxiety to asthma. I mean, there's tons of different causes for it. So it happens to everyone, and it happens for many, many different reasons.
What are some telltale signs that you're having a problem, you know, with chest pains as opposed to, you know, just heartburn or an upset stomach?
Well, so, I mean, the classic symptoms, each of the sort of bad things has classic symptoms. So, for example, heart attack. The classic symptoms, so that's just like what we expect to see, is things like chest pressure. So oftentimes people don't feel pain per se. They feel like it's a squeezing chest pressure. They might not even say pain. And along with that, they often feel short of breath, and they feel dizzy, like lightheaded, nausea, and sometimes they're sweating a lot as well. Those, and sometimes it radiates up to the jaw and into the arm. It's not just in the chest. That's sort of the classic picture for chest pain related to a heart attack, but it's not, what's important to note is that it's not the same for everyone, for sure, and especially diabetics tend to have different symptoms. Like, sometimes they just feel like they're having heartburn, or sometimes they may just feel short of breath. Women also tend to have different symptoms from men, like not as classic as of the symptoms as I mentioned, so oftentimes they may get more back pain or more nausea as opposed to that chest pressure that we think about. So those are sort of the classic things for heart attack type chest pain. And then for other things, we have other sort of other types of pain, like the things we worry about in the emergency department are the things that kill you. So the chest pains that kill people are things like heart attack and aortic dissection, which is where the big blood vessel that comes off the heart called the aorta will basically tear. And that's called dissection. And that pain is like, well, like I mentioned, it's a tearing. So it actually feels like a tearing pain. It typically goes into the back, and it may be associated with things like neurological symptoms. So weakness in one side, for example, or severe pain in an arm or a limb. And so that's another one we think of. And a third one right off the top of my head is something called the pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot in the lungs. And that's associated also with pain, which is also in the chest, but it's more what we call a pleuritic chest pain, which means it's worse when you breathe in. It's usually sharp, as opposed to like the other types of pains I mentioned. So it's a sharp pain. It's worse when you take a breath in. And also oftentimes people who have that feel short of breath as well when they exert themselves at all. And oftentimes what we look for in those people, I'll mention one more symptom, which is sometimes they'll cough up blood, but not all the time. And what we'll look for in those people, what we always do is we look for risk factors, you know, things that would lead us to believe that this person may be at risk for getting those things. So the ones I was thinking of for pulmonary embolism are things like recent travel, long-distance travel, like if you've flown for more than 4 hours, for example, or if you've been on any kind of hormonal therapy, or if you've had cancer, or if you're pregnant, all those things increase the risk that you could have a pulmonary embolism. So that's what we end up doing when we have someone with symptoms. The history, the story is really just as important as anything else, as the physical exam and as the tests that we do to lead us along the path of getting the right diagnosis.
The aortic dissection that you talked about a few moments ago, first of all, I think that's the thing that killed actor John Ritter, right? Like a few years ago? Was that?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So do you sort of die immediately? Like, I think he had pain for a couple of hours right before he actually passed away.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, some people do. If it tears right open, this is a big, big blood vessel with a lot of blood pressure in it. So if it tears right open and, you know, all the blood escapes, really there's nothing, you know, there's no way to be saved, you know, then it's basically like an instant death. But oftentimes you just have a little leak, like a little tear, and the body is pretty good at patching, at least temporarily patching these leaks. So oftentimes, and it sounds like that was the case for John Ritter as well, and some the people we see sometimes that come in with pain, and it may not be, the problem is it's not always obvious, you know, the difference between that and a heart attack, and in many cases, and then the problem is the treatment is completely different. So if you think it's a heart attack, they go to the cath lab, which is where they do the angioplasty, but that's not, and also they end up being anticoagulated, so we thin their blood, but that's completely not the right treatment for an aortic dissection. So if you guess wrong, which is easy to do, unfortunately, then you can actually do harm or definitely not help the person. And it is a sort of, oftentimes you do have a limited time window in which to save the person's life with an aortic dissection or any of those things, actually. But that's why, you know, in a case like, you know, John Ritter's or other people's, it's a daunting diagnosis because you really have no room for error. And one of the problems is when people come into the emergency department and they are unstable, like they have a low blood pressure or they're really, really, really sick, you can't do all the tests you want to do to make sure of your diagnosis. Like for often, like one of the great tests for aortic dissection is a CT angiogram, so a CAT scan, where they inject dye and they can look at the aorta, but you can't send someone to the CT suite and do that test unless they're stable, unless they're okay, because they're out of the emergency department at that time. They're in radiology, and that if they, you know, if they stop breathing or whatever, they can't really be resuscitated properly there. So oftentimes you can't do the great tests that you want to do to make the diagnosis properly, and so you're left with suboptimal tests and trying to make treatment decisions as quickly as you can without all the information you would love to have.
When you're in the ER, Dr. Zach, like, what do you see, I guess, what's the most common chest pain that you see? Is it, you know, heading towards heart attack? Is that what you see the most?
We see a lot. I mean, there have been studies on it that I've looked at, and it varies a lot depending on your population. So, for example, I work at the Montreal General and at the Royal Victoria Hospital. The Royal Victoria Hospital, they have a big cardiac program, so a lot of heart disease patients. So a lot of them, when they come in with chest pain, it's frequently their heart that's giving them the chest pain, but that's largely because it's, you know, that's the population that comes to that hospital. But we also see there and other places a lot of young people that come in with chest pain. Unfortunately, some of them it is heart-related illness or serious things, but very frequently, and this is anywhere, you know, other things can cause chest pain, including things like a panic attack, which can very easily mimic like heart attack type symptoms. They often give chest pain and shortness of breath and dizziness and nausea, palpitations. So that can be very difficult to distinguish. And when they look at what the different causes of chest pain that come in, you know, depending on which population, the study I saw showed that there's a lot of people who come in with anxiety-related symptoms. There's a lot of just musculoskeletal, so basically pain in the muscles and the bones around the chest, and that can give you, you know, that's chest pain as well, so you have to distinguish that from a heart attack. And then, of course, the other things I mentioned, that the other serious causes, so heart attack and aortic dissection and pulmonary embolism.
Something I wanted to ask you, and I know I'm probably going to come off sounding a little naive about this question, but it's just because I obviously I'm not a doctor. Do you have any symptoms that are similar between a stroke and a heart attack? Like, or are they completely separate issues?
Well, they're not, you know, I think they can be considered together because what they are, in terms of what causes them, they're very similar. But to distinguish them is usually not that difficult because they're affecting different parts of the body. So they're both, for a while, I don't know if they still are, but the neurologists were using the term brain attack for a stroke, so that basically it was thought of the same way as a heart attack. And that actually makes sense because what a stroke is basically you're not getting enough blood to feed the brain properly. And that's the same thing as a heart attack, except with the heart. So, and the causes are very similar. Usually there's a blockage of an artery. Sometimes in the brain, less commonly, but sometimes you can have bleeding in the brain. But actually, what ends up happening is the same thing. The brain is not getting enough blood the way it's supposed to and getting enough nutrients, and so parts of the brain can die. And that's the exact same thing as a heart attack in the sense that a heart attack is when you're not getting effective blood supply to the heart. And so the heart muscle always needs to be fed nutrients and oxygen. And if it doesn't get those things, then parts of the heart muscle can die. So they are very similar in terms of what causes them. Now, but in terms of distinguishing them, usually they're quite different because a stroke affects the brain. So when parts of the brain don't work, you're not able to do the things that the brain controls, which is usually it's on one side of the brain. And as you may know, one side of the brain controls the other side of the body. So very common symptoms for someone having a stroke are they can't move one side of their body, or they feel very numb on one side of the body, or sometimes they can't speak, or other parts of the brain, they can have very severe vertigo, nausea, vomiting, inability to walk straight, those sorts of things. And that's relatively straightforward to distinguish from a heart attack, because the heart attack symptoms usually don't give you neurological symptoms, so they usually don't make you weak or numb per se, or difficult, or they can, a heart attack can make people dizzy, can make them throw up, but usually doesn't give them the other neurological symptoms that we look for in a stroke. So usually we can tell them apart, but one of the things I mentioned earlier, the aortic dissection, one of the things it can do is sometimes cause neurological symptoms. So sometimes if someone comes in with chest pain and weakness in an arm or in their leg, is something you definitely have to think of. And the reason for that is that as the aorta dissects, if there's a part of the aorta that's torn and you're not getting blood supply from the aorta to a nerve, for example, that supplies the leg, then the leg will become weak. So that can sometimes be a little bit more difficult to distinguish between.
And when it comes to prevention, what do you want people to keep in their minds with regards to like chest pain and all of this stuff?
Well, you know, in general, there's no question that, you know, all of these things are at least related. I'm talking about like heart attack and aortic dissection and stroke when I'm saying all these things. Those are all related to cardiovascular health. So, you know, the best things you can do in terms of if you're doing something to stop something, it has to be to stop smoking. There's no question that's going to help you out a lot. And in terms of what to do, is to get active, get physically active. So as much physical activity as you can do, you know, cardiovascular activity, even whatever you can do, you know, if you can walk, if you can run, if you can swim, if you can bike, anything to get your heart pumping regularly. And then the other thing is see your doctor, because all these things are related to, we have these things that we measure, as you know, things like cholesterol and blood pressure and blood sugar, blood glucose. So all those things can be measured and we want them to be well controlled. So they'll definitely all improve if you're not smoking and you're exercising. And in some people, and diet as well, a better diet will help. And in some people, medications may be necessary. I mean, as you know, a lot of people take different medications, either for blood pressure or cholesterol or diabetes. And, you know, it's not the first choice for anyone, actually, I don't think, to take medications. But if you're doing the other stuff and it's still not where you want it to be, you know, for example, your blood pressure is, you just can't get it down to a safe range, then sometimes you do have to take a medication. It's just, even if you don't want to, you know, it's better for your health to be safe.
Awesome. Dr. Zach, thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kelly.
That's Dr. Zachary Levine, an ER physician at the Montreal General Hospital, joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
We're happy to be joined on the show by a band that is making a lot of noise across Canada as well as the U.S., Hey Ocean, who have performed at many amazing places, including the Oceaga Festival in Montreal, the Virgin Festival in Calgary, and the list goes on and on. We're joined right now by lead guitar player and vocalist Dave Beckingham. Dave, welcome to The Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks so much.
We're happy to have you. And for those who may not know you, where is the band actually from, and how did you guys, you know, sort of come together as a group?
We're from Vancouver, so we're based here, and I guess we came together. Ashley and I, the lead singer, and I have known each other since we were in grade 6 when our sisters tried to set us up. And fast forward to about when we were 19 years old, we started playing open mics together. We met David Vertesi somewhere in there, started the band around, 2004. So, yeah, and the rest is kind of history. We've had a few different drummers in the mix, but put out 3 albums, and
And how would you describe your sound?
Well, we kind of make indie pop music, so it's sort of changed over the last few albums, and we never want to make the same. We always say we never want to make the same album twice, but it's definitely upbeat. It's upbeat, sort of happy, positive indie pop. There are some more sort of emotional love songs in the mix, but it's kind of indie poppy. We wanted to make it sort of a classic pop album, so we took a lot of inspiration from Fleetwood Mac and Paul Simon, some more classic songwriters for this last album, and
the latest album is called Is, right?
Is, correct.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So can you tell us, you know, why you called it that? And, you know, you've sort of talked a little bit about the album itself, but what do you want people to take away from it?
Well, you know, it's the title. This album was kind of a journey for us emotionally, and it was a bit of a coming of age, and we learned a lot about ourselves through kind of a crazy process. We started with one producer, ended up spending a lot of money. That whole thing flopped. The relationship flopped, and we kind of learned a lot about kind of what it is to be who we are instead of what, you know, like sometimes you go into a record and you're like, okay, this record, we really want these things to happen with this album. And it was kind of a good lesson in like, that's not why you make a record. You make a record because you want this music to be out there. And our focus was just a little wrong. And so we didn't really know how to make the kind of record that we wanted to make with this one producer. So it flopped and the relationship split up, and we had spent a ton of money, and we came back to Vancouver kind of distraught, and ended up self-producing the album that we wanted to make after we sort of put the pieces back together. And so it was just a real kind of coming of age album for us. So we called it Is, because that's kind of how we felt like this is who we are right now. And we thought it was a cool word because it's never been used, and it never really gets used by itself too.
Right.
So I don't know. We tossed around a few ideas for the name, and that's what we ended up with. So.
You mentioned earlier that as a band, you guys keep sort of rotating drummers. Is that difficult for you? Like, do you hope to one, like, you know, and maybe the person you have now is the one, but like, do you wish that you had that person that is there? Because obviously that's such an important role in the band to keep everybody together.
It for sure is. And yes, we have an amazing drummer, and we've worked with a bunch of amazing drummers. And for whatever reason, things haven't necessarily worked out with people in the past, and not for negative reasons. I think maybe one was a little just sort of a difference in personality and didn't work out. But a lot of people who are making art and stuff, especially in Vancouver, are doing a lot of different things. So some people are drummers and they make films, and, you know, drummers and they want to get married and go to Australia or whatever it is, you know what I mean? So, our drummer now, Johnny Andrews, is an amazing drummer, and we love working with him and hope to work with him for a long time. So,
what song right now in the band's repertoire would you say best describes the band as a whole?
I would say with this last record, it's kind of hard to say because we have 3 lead vocalists in terms of Like, I take the spotlight on a couple songs. Ashley sings the majority, but David Vertesi, our bass player as well, sings lead on some of the tunes. So, but I think, you know, any of the songs where you can hear the three voices a lot singing harmonies together. So, I mean, I Am a Heart is one that comes to mind, which has kind of just a lot of three-part harmony stuff. And then Make a New Dance Up has been a really fun song this record. It's gotten a lot of really, really fun reaction. When we play it live, we just encourage people to make silly dances up or just kind of let loose, and it's really fun for us. And, you know, it's getting spun on the radio in Canada now, and so it's another one that's kind of a good sort of Hey Ocean introduction song.
When we talk about other bands in the Canadian industry, the music industry, is there a band that sticks out to you that, you know, not that you would want to emulate them, but like you appreciate how their career has gone and you hope yours would sort of follow along that path? Is there a band out there now that you can say is doing that or has done that, what you want to do?
We do follow different bands in Canada for sure. And we get to sort of see how people are progressing and the decisions that they make and the effect that those decisions have and how people are responding to their music. I wouldn't say there's one band in particular, but it's always nice watching our friends too. Like mm-hmm. we came up in the Vancouver music scene, which has been a very healthy music scene and had a lot of great bands come out of at least the BC sort of area in the last little while. And Yukon Blonde and Said the Whale and Hannah Georges. It's really, and Mother Mother and stuff. It's fun watching them progress. In terms of bigger bands in Canada, yeah, no, we don't really, you know, compare
right
in that way mm-hmm. necessarily, but we just watch and we observe and, you know, we kind of try and learn from what we see.
When you're touring, because you do quite a bit of touring, you know, across Canada, I know you're going into the States as well and overseas. Do you notice a difference in the audiences depending on where you are? And is there an area that you really appreciate being? Like, obviously, I know home is home, so, you know, Vancouver must have mm-hmm. a special place in your heart. But is there some place that maybe even surprises you how much you like being at?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we feel like there are some homes away from home, cities and stuff. So Toronto would be one. And I think LA has been really good for us. And that's always nice. New York, this last time we played New York was really, really great. So Calgary in Canada. And we love coming to Montreal. Our last show in Montreal was amazing too. So yeah, we definitely have some favorites.
That's great. Well, it's nice to always hear, you know, different artists, like where they sort of, you know, feel at home when it's not home. So I think that's really cool. And what, you know, would you say about social media for you guys as a band? Has it really helped sort of get the word out for you?
For sure. Yeah, it continues to be, you know, kind of the platform from like which to communicate with your fans and stuff. So it's definitely helped us a lot. It helped us sort of rally people when we've been trying to do things. We made a fan submission video that we just made for our song Make a New Dance Up. And so it's a bunch of videos of people like I mentioned before, doing kind of like silly dances or whatever, and that was really fun, and that was all done online. So there's no denying how helpful that is and just sort of activating people and keeping them kind of stoked on what you're doing. And for us too, like seeing the support through that and hearing people talk about, you know, our tunes and, mm-hmm. you know.
What is up next for you guys in the next like 6 months to a year, let's say, like a lot more touring? Do you plan to do any maybe like try to get your songs on more television? Like, because I know that that's happened already. What are the goals of the band for the immediate future?
To make a new record is becoming definitely a bigger goal in our minds. And then we're kind of perpetually on the road. We like to kind of just stay active that way. But we definitely want to take some time toward Christmas and stuff and look at the new songs we've been writing. And we've demoed a bunch of them and sort of try and pull together the remainders of a new album, which we're really excited to record. And then, yeah, more touring is always on the horizon. So, well, the TV stuff just kind of, it happens when it happens. So, yeah, we've got a publishing company that kind of takes care of that stuff. So it's kind of out of our control, but they're always working on it. So,
well, Dave, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for hanging out on the show.
Okay, thanks for having me.
That's Dave Beckingham from Hey Ocean. Make sure to check them out on their website, lovehayocean.com. As always, a big thank you going out to my guests this week, Dr. Frank Farley, Patrick Charles, Dr. Zach Levine, as well as Canadian group Hey Ocean. I want to leave you with an inspirational quote of the week, this time from Tim Ferriss. Hard work becomes easy when your work becomes your play. Never underestimate the value of loving what you do. Don't forget to check us out on social media, on Twitter, at Kay Alexander Show, Facebook, Kelly Alexander Show, and of course our YouTube channel, youtube.com/KellyAlexanderShow. All of our interviews online for you to check out. Any comments or questions, drop me a line, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.